This morning, the clerk has two causes to be submitted on oral argument. First cause is Victoria Bank and Trust Company versus Brady and others from Victoria County. Court will allow 30 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 10 minutes for the petitioner to offer rebuttal. Second cause is Fred Masinga versus the 160th Judicial District on original mandamus proceeding. Court will allow 10 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of these two causes. Counsel, the second cause should remain nearby so that we can proceed to your argument without delay when the first cause, when our break is over, but you do not have to remain in the courtroom. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Any interested party may make application with our clerk to hear the tapes of these arguments. We're pleased to have students from Leander Middle School here to watch the first argument this morning. The court is now ready to hear oral argument for petitioner in Victoria Bank and Trust versus Brady.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeff Hall and Mr. Mark Lehman will present argument for petitioner. Mr. Hall, hello.
May it please the court. I'm here today and with me at council table, Jim Paulson and Andy Taylor and John Murphy representing Victoria Bank and Trust. Also at council table is Mr. Mark Lehman from the Office of the Comptroller. We're here today on a case that comes by application from the 13th Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi. Before looking at the legal issues, which we believe are significant in this case, at least those at which we can look given the time, I think it's important to lay some of the facts of this case before the court. Facts are important in at least three respects in connection with this argument. Number one, it's significant to understand some of the facts relating to the structure of the loan that was involved between Mr. Brady and Mr. Fancher on the one hand and Victoria Bank and Trust on the other. Mr. Fancher and Mr. Brady wanted a loan. Victoria Bank and Trust was in the business of lending money. Victoria Bank and Trust wanted collateral for their loan, and they wanted a first lien on that collateral. Mr. Brady had some land that could stand as collateral for that loan. One problem. There was a first lien on that property, which was held by Winter Garden Production Credit Association, and it was not available to be used for collateral. So an agreement was reached. Mr. Brady and Mr. Fancher would borrow the money. The first lien at Winter Garden would be paid off. And Mr. Fancher would personally guarantee the debt. His cattle company, a corporation, was the borrower. Under the loan documents, the bank was not obligated to fund the loan until it had in hand a first lien. However, when you look at the facts of the case, those facts demonstrate that that is not what in fact happened. Even though Victoria Bank and Trust, under the documentation, was not obligated to fund the loan until such time as it had in hand a first lien. The record shows that after the loan documentation was executed on November 21st in 1983, that an initial funding of the loan was made in December 12, 1983. Those funds were paid into an escrow account. It was the amount of money necessary to pay off Winter Garden PCA. There was a delay in getting that arrangement completed of a little better than a month. And in between the time that the funds were put into escrow in December 12th of 1983 and the time that the lien was transferred from Winter Garden PCA to Victoria Bank and Trust, there was an advance of monies under this credit. It was advanced for the purpose of being used in the business of Brady and Fancher, and that was buying and selling of cattle. Finally, on January the 18th, the lien was transferred for the first time to Winter Garden PCA, from Winter Garden PCA to Victoria Bank and Trust. Things went along well for a while, but finally the note came into default. And during this period of time, Mr. Fancher, in addition to carrying on his business as a partner with Mr. Brady, was individually borrowing money from Victoria Bank and Trust for a personal business in buying and selling of cattle. Around September the 9th of 1985, Mr. Fancher sold some cattle to Mr. Bill Richardson. The money that had been used to buy that cattle was not related to the Fancher-Brady loan. Victoria Bank and Trust had financed it, but it was a separate loan to Mr. Fancher. That loan contained some cross-collateralization language. And although it had been paid off, Victoria Bank and Trust believed, and I think the record demonstrates, we'll discuss that later, that money was still owed by Mr. Fancher individually to Victoria Bank and Trust. As we said, the loan was in default. Mr. Fancher sold the cattle to Mr. Richardson. Mr. Richardson happened to be a depositor with Victoria Bank and Trust. So Mr. Fancher, with his draft from Mr. Richardson, drawn on Victoria Bank and Trust, came into Victoria Bank and Trust to present the draft for payment. There was on the back of that draft a bill of sale which said and required that there be attached a release of any liens or mortgages that were against the cattle being sold to Mr. Richardson. On the front of that draft was an instruction which said that the draft should not be honored unless all of those liens had been released. Now, Victoria Bank and Trust believed it had a lien under its cross-collateralization clause. Mr. Barnhart, the Victoria Bank officer, pointed out to Mr. Brady, "We believe we've got a lien." Excuse me, Mr. Fancher. And Mr. Fancher's response was, "Wait a minute. You can't have a lien on those cattle. Another bank has a lien on those cattle." So here's Victoria Bank and Trust. They have a draft which says don't pay it unless the liens have been released. They believe they have a lien. They've been told by Mr. Fancher that another bank has a lien. And they're between a rock and a hard place. And I suggest that the record will demonstrate that Victoria Bank and Trust reasonably believed that it had a lien. An agreement was reached. Victoria Bank and Trust would release its lien in return for $40,000 of the proceeds from this sale. The dispute became rather warm at this point. Victoria Bank and Trust was pursuing Mr. Brady for closing on his land down in Zafala County. Mr. Fancher and his lawyer flew with the bankers and their lawyers down to Zavala County, where Mr. Brady had filed a lawsuit seeking to restrain the foreclosure. Mr. Brady, of course, was trying to keep his land from being foreclosed upon, and Mr. Fancher was interested in helping to stop that foreclosure. In fact, a plea and intervention had been prepared by his lawyers, and we'll be talking about that. Mr. Fancher agreed to pay $40,000 of the proceeds of the draft to Victoria Bank and Trust. And it's significant to remember that when he did, he sent them a letter which said, "Neither I nor Fancher Cattle Company intend nor do we release any claim or cause of action that we have against Victoria Bank and Trust." Down at the courthouse in Zavala County, an agreement was reached which settled the dispute between everybody. That agreement was reduced to writing. It was signed by Mr. Fancher. It was signed by Mr. Fancher's lawyer, who represented him at the hearing. The bank returned $20,000 of the $40,000 it had received. Mr. Brady paid the bank $10,000, and the bank extended the time for payment of the Brady-Fancher loan. And an all-inclusive release of all claims, causes of action was signed in connection with that settlement. That case and that posture went to trial in Victoria County before the Honorable Clarence Stevenson. The jury returned a verdict in which it answered all questions against Victoria Bank and Trust. The trial judge set aside the findings as to usury and entered judgment. The Court of Appeals affirmed the judgment as to everything except, at least as far as the bank was concerned, except the usury count, and it reversed and remanded, excuse me, and rendered judgment against the bank and instated for the first time usury penalties. In doing so, I suggest to this court that the Court of Appeals turned on its head several significant legal principles that govern important areas of law in this state. They relate to release, they relate to agency, they relate to usury, they relate to the DTPA. Let's talk about agency. Certainly there is in the law a presumption that everybody is presumed to know the law. The Court of Appeals seems to have written a little exception into that rule, which reads like this. Everyone is presumed to know the law except when he hires a lawyer. I suggest that the record establishes that Mr. Fancher, first of all, knew of his usury claim himself. The plea and intervention that had been prepared recited facts related to that usury claim. This was before the release was ever signed. Now, one thing I think is certain, one of two things. Either those facts were related to Mr. Fancher's lawyers by Mr. Fancher, or his lawyers made them up. And I think only one reasonable conclusion can be drawn, and that is that Mr. Fancher related those facts. So he knew facts that gave rise to a claim for usury. And knowing the facts, he's presumed to know the law. Now, the Court of Appeals recognized and said it is appropriate to impute to Mr. Fancher knowledge of facts known by his lawyer. But then they added something and said it is not appropriate to impute to the client the knowledge, the legal knowledge of the lawyer. Now, I wonder what Mr. Fancher was paying for. He was paying for legal advice. He was paying for knowledge of legal theories. Number one. Number two, in addition to setting up that rule that you can't impute legal knowledge to a client, I believe the Court of Appeals contradicted prior rulings of this court. For instance, in Rotello versus State, this court upheld a dismissal of a lawsuit and did so on the basis that the client was charged with his lawyer's legal knowledge of a local rule relating to a dismissal doctrine. And if a client is charged with knowledge of a local rule, then surely he is charged with knowledge of usury. If his lawyer is aware of that legal theory, and the lawyer surely, along with the client, can be presumed to know the law. Now keep in mind one of the facts we recited earlier at this point, and that is that a letter had been sent to Victoria Bank and Trust when the $40,000 was paid in connection with the Richardson cattle transaction. And that letter had said, signed by Mr. Fancher, neither I nor the cattle company intend nor do we release. He knew the word. Any claim or cause of action that we have against Victoria Bank and Trust. He knew he had claims. He knew he had causes of action. So not only does the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi say that you don't impute legal knowledge, they go beyond that as a practical matter and say you don't impute legal knowledge as long as the lawyer doesn't put a label on the claim or the cause of action. Mr. Fancher knew he had a claim. He knew he had a claim. And I submit he knew facts that gave rise to the claim of usury, which he related to his lawyer. Secondly,
before you pass from that,
yes, Your Honor.
How does, even if you're correct, how does the release survive the jury's answer to question 12?
The jury survives the answer to question 12 because, number one, mutual mistake has been set aside, not appealed from. It's basically out of the case. Number two, we'll talk about consideration. That was my next point. Number three, you have left, I believe it's the second and third subparts of question 12, which relate to cloaking usurious transaction in good faith. I submit very quickly for the court's consideration on those that those are basically the same element. That in looking at good faith, you never see it discussed in the usury context, and that's what we're talking about here, unless it's discussed in connection with some other element, and that element usually is a cloak to set aside a usurious transaction. Truth of the matter is, there is no reason anymore in the law, since intent is not related to whether a bank commits usury or not, to really consider good faith. And I submit that that's been the law at least since Alamo Lumber. If intent has nothing to do, or good faith, with whether you commit usury or not, it seems that it shouldn't be in whether a release is set aside. In addition to that, I think it is also worthy of observation in connection with the presence or absence of good faith that the seminal case, Finn B. Alexander, really, I hesitate to say confuses, but I guess if I express my state of mind, that's exactly what happens. Because the good faith in that case it talks about is the good faith of the payer of the usurious interest, not of the bank that's lending. And what I think it's getting at is whether or not you've got some subterfuge to try and disguise usury. And there really isn't any accusation of that in this case. Plus the fact, if he knew about the usury claim, then it's fairly obvious nothing was cloaked.
Was there a claim for rescission of the release for violation of the DTPA in this case?
I don't recall one, Your Honor. Let's talk about consideration, if I might, because I think the law of consideration has been turned on its head by the Court of Appeals as well. The Court of Appeals concentrated in its decision on direct monetary consideration, said there was none because the money that was returned to Mr. Fancher was really his own, and so there was no consideration. I suggest that that ignores several other rather obvious forms of consideration in this case. Number one, the law is very clear that consideration can be some benefit that flows on behalf of the agreeing parties to a third party. Mr. Brady was involved, and certainly benefit flowed to Mr. Brady in this case, which was benefit to Mr. Fancher. Secondly, and perhaps more important, there can't be any question, based upon the letter that Mr. Fancher sent to Victoria Bank and Trust, say, I'm not releasing anything, that there were some genuine bona fide disputes between those parties. And it's well settled that any time you settle a bona fide dispute, that is consideration for an agreement. There certainly was a settlement in this case of a bona fide dispute. And the fact that Mr. Fancher won the lawsuit doesn't mean that is not correct. If you've got to win a lawsuit before you know whether a release is effective or not, then we might as well forget about settling lawsuits. Because before you can determine whether the settlement is effective, you've got to have another lawsuit. And so I think they've turned the law on consideration on their head. Plus, I think the record demonstrates that there was monetary consideration. I think it's demonstrated first and foremost by a judicial admission which has been made in the record by the plaintiff in the figures, by Mr. Fancher in the figures that he gave to the Court of Appeals to figure the usury penalty. You know, to figure usury, you've got to base it on how much was owed, how much interest could you have charged. And if you look at a very important chart, and it's in our briefs, and it's summarized in our briefs, if you look at the chart, he says that as of the date of the Richardson cattle transaction, the amount owing was $35,000 and change. Now, he doesn't like to get caught with that judicial admission. But it seems that if he can use it to get usury penalties, we ought to be able to at least use it as well to show that even he admits there was consideration at this point in time. I suggest, in addition, that the Court of Appeals opinion turns the DTPA on its head. Keep in mind that the issue that went to the jury was whether or not there had been a deceptive act, etc., in connection with the Richardson cattle transaction. Very carefully, they picked their transaction. And they went to the jury on that transaction. Now my question is, in the Richardson cattle transaction, who was the consumer? Mr. Fancher? Mr. Fancher was selling cattle. Who was the consumer? Mr. Richardson was the customer of the bank. To whom did Victoria Bank and Trust owe a duty in connection with that draft? I think the answer is found in another question. What causes of action would Mr. Richardson have had against the bank had the bank paid that draft without those liens having been released contrary to the instructions of the draft?
Well, I assume the argument goes that Mr. Fancher was a consumer regards to Brady transactions with the bank. The promise that he would not be held personally liable on those transactions was false, and the use of the Richardson transaction to get money out of him to pay that obligation was a violation of the statute. What's wrong with that argument?
Several things, Your Honor. Number one, it mixes up transactions. It looks to one transaction for a part of the two-pronged test established by this court and to another transaction for another aspect of it. I think also ignores the fact that Mr. Fancher did not go to the jury on that loan. He went to the jury on the Richardson cattle transaction. He delineated the transaction. And so he's got his transactions mixed. This court in Lacerra Grain very clearly delineated that you can have more than one transaction involved in a situation and be a consumer as to one and not as to the other. Lacerra was a consumer as to the breach of warranty claim, but it was not a consumer as to the loan transaction that was involved in that. And I submit that Mr. Fancher was not a consumer in the loan transaction because it was a pure extension of credit. That's all it was. It was used in his business, to conduct his business. He didn't come in and say, I've got a set of cows out here and I want to buy this set of cows. He had a business which was engaged in buying and selling cattle. And if you read the DTPA cases very carefully, they generally deal with a house, a car, a something else, something specific. And this was just a loan to conduct his business. And if that brings one within the two-pronged test of seeking goods or services, then there isn't any loan in the world that can be a pure extension of credit because everybody intends to use the money for something. That's the reason they borrow it. Secondly, I think he misses it because his complaint doesn't arise out of the transaction which he's seeking to recover for. He didn't have any complaint about any cows. We've been trying forever to get some word on exactly what the good or service was. And until the response brief in this case, we didn't have it. The only thing that we've been told to this point is that, well, they tried to enforce a lien. Now, a lien is not a service to a customer. It's a protection for the bank. I don't really recall anybody going to the bank and saying, I want to buy a lien for some of my property. The bank usually requires it. It's to protect the bank. It is not a service to the customer.
Counsel, what about the argument that the extension of credit is a service?
Well, this court has held that a pure extension of credit does not fall within the DTPA. That's Lacerra Grain. And as long as it's a pure extension of credit, you do not qualify as a consumer. And so I think that on that basis, he would not be a consumer.
That's based on the Riverside case, though, and we've carved out several exceptions to Riverside from credit.
That is correct, Your Honor. You've carved out a number of exceptions to it. But though exceptions have been carved out, it is still good law that a pure extension of credit does not bring you within the DTPA.
One of those exceptions is when you extend credit to buy goods, it's no longer just a loan. It has to do with the consumer.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I submit that, as I suggested a while ago, that a careful reading of the cases suggests that that is in the context of a specific, identifiable good or property. That is not the case here. He just borrowed money to run his business, which happened to be the buying and selling of cattle. He had a line of credit. It wasn't even a specific loan for a specific purpose. It was a line of credit to be used when and as needed. So I think in these respects, the court has turned the law on its head. There are other aspects in which the same has been done. And we don't have time to discuss those, and I respectfully invite the court's attention to the briefs that have been filed for a discussion of those matters. And we pray the court to reverse and to render the judgment of the Court of Appeals below. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents. We have additional.
May it please the court, Mr. Lehman will continue arguments for petitioner.
I apologize.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Lehman, and I represent the United States Comptroller of the Currency, who's the federal administrator of the National Bank. The Comptroller's primary purpose in filing our amicus brief and in sending me here today is to urge that this court not endorse what the Comptroller perceives to be a new usury rule that was invented by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals has created a rule whereby money owed to one lender can be attributed for usury calculation purposes to the interest being charged by an unrelated lender. On its face, we think this really is unfair because the purpose of usury laws is to curtail the excesses of unprincipled creditors. After all, what's the point of punishing a lender where the wrongful interest could never have been realized by that lender? We feel that upon closer examination, this new rule is much worse, however. In our brief, we gave a hypothetical to illustrate one spin how this could affect consumer credit in Texas. Our hypothetical concerned a husband with a family business who goes to a Texas bank and fills out the credit application. And on the application, he lists a credit card debt from his wife. She has a MasterCard from a bank in South Dakota with a 20% plus interest rate. Because the bank's loan officer looks at the couple's monthly ability to pay, he's worried about it, and he says, well, why don't we make this loan a little bit bigger? Why don't you pay off this this crazy credit card, and then you'll be in a better position to service your debt with us. The husband agrees. This hypothetical is typical. It happens every day in banks, and indeed, our examiners realize a loan officer who did something differently. One thing a loan officer is supposed to do is look at monthly paying capacity. You don't want your borrowers to be overextended.
This is what's commonly called loan consolidation.
It's loan consolidation when it's the same person. The spin I was putting on this was the family business, but two different creditors. So I guess a variation, but not exactly. Under the rules I read it by the Court of Appeals, this transaction, though, would be usurious because the money that would go to pay the bank in South Dakota, that interest would be attributed to the Texas loan. We think that that's out result and could not is both unfair and pernicious to the market. We think basically the Court of Appeals has confused interest with collateral. Collateral is property pledged to protect an asset, and the asset is the income from a loan. That's indeed the main assets for banks is a loan income. Collateral is a hedge against default. It really has nothing to do with the direct cost of borrowing to the consumer. Banks do not want their loans to default. For one thing, they get a lot more money if the loans are paid off, and collateral is really like it's a hedge. You're going to get something out of it, but it's not what you want when you make a loan. However, even if Victoria Bank's requirement that it be given a priority lien on the collateral in this case can be deemed a charge made on the loan, the Comptroller believes that ample precedent exists in Texas for the proposition that there was a benefit. And the benefit here is that the collateralized property was freed up to be used again and they could get a larger borrowing.
You say these are common occurrences, and yet Mr. Fancher argues that the testimony in this case that it was not a common occurrence. What's the response to that?
I'm just saying what the bank examiners tell me is that when they go out and they examine the banks and they watch how the loan officers are doing, the main thing that that they stress to them is to watch that monthly ability to make the payment and where they can. They can group things together, make a monthly payment, it's better.
I suppose whether it's a common occurrence or not is important to you only in the sense that it's prompted your presence here and not, it doesn't detract or add to your argument one way or the other.
No, sir, it does not. To sum up, the controller believes that when a loan contract is not usurious on its face, any additional charges ought not to be assessed as interest unless they either amount to disguised interest or are assessed as additional charges to the loan without conferring an additional benefit on the borrower. The financial services industry cannot function without certainty, and we believe the Court of Appeals has thrown a spin into the law in Texas and has given ambiguity to the Alamo Lumber case. Just in conclusion, the controller urges the court to reject the new rule, and in any event, it would be most helpful, we believe, if this court confirm whether or not Alamo Lumber applies to multiple borrowers.
Any questions? Thank you, Tim. Now we're ready to hear arguments from the
court. May it please the court, Mr. James Cronza and Mr. Dan Fontaine will present arguments for the respondent, Mr. Cronza Willis.
May it please the court, I suppose I'll probably be the chief messer-upper here, and the designated hitter and chief cleaner-upper is going to follow, so I've asked them to give me some notice. What Mr. Lehman says, I think, kind of goes to the jugular of this case. It seems to me that what he told the court today is no more nor less than an attack upon the gold opinion. And from our viewpoint, the ultimate bottom line raised by them throughout this appeal is whether gold or the principles of gold written by this court 6 or 7 years ago by authored by Justice Pope are good law. Now, the majority of the cases in the country holds that gold is good law. In gold, as the court will recall, Mrs. Gold was required to assume a debt with Alamo Lumber Company that was then owed by a relative who was having trouble with the paper. And this court held, as I say, in accordance with the clear majority of cases in this country, that that required her to assume the debt and obligation of another. And that amount of money that was not for her benefit or was she was being required to assume was extra interest for purposes of our usury statutes. Now, there can't be anything clearer than that. Yet, not only Mr. Lehman and the Comptroller, but the Attorney General's amicus brief, and the Texas Bankers' amicus brief, and the American Bankers joined with them, all are no more nor less than thinly veiled attacks upon the gold principle.
Do you agree, Mr. Cronza, that if the loan had been to Brady alone, and as a requirement, he had been obliged to buy First Lend by paying down Winter Garden production PCA, that would not be a usurious transaction?
So long as, Justice said, so long as Mr. Fancher, what didn't give his, that $121,000 deducted from the credit line, and that was the first transaction, not what Mr. Hall said.
But let me segment it out here. If okay. It had just been Mr. Brady, and he wanted to borrow money, and Victoria Bank wanted a First Lend, and they said, you got to go pay off the PCA to give us a First Lend, there wouldn't be any, you wouldn't complain that was usurious.
No, as a matter of fact.
And if the loan had been solely to Mr. Fancher, and he had been required to go pay off some other loan or do something to discharge Mr. Brady's indebtedness, that would be pretty squarely under Alamo Lumber, the gold case.
That's right.
And so the complication here is Mr. Brady and Mr. Fancher were partners.
Well, that's what they wrote into the papers. The first transaction, they were not called papers, partners. The bank, out of his presence and without his authority, wrote that into the transaction. But even if that were so, Your Honor, to subject him, he only got a $29,000 line of credit out of it. The first deduction from that $150,000 line was Mr. Brady's $121,000, leaving him obligated for the entirety, but only having available to his use some $21,000. And add to the nature of this whole, these three transactions, there were three transactions here, what's so astonishing to me is that in the cattle business, and in this case, the ordinary way a lending institution lends and finances and gets its collateral in transactions involving animals is to take a lien on those cattle as purchased, advance the money. They had done that here and went this step further. I don't know why they thought Brady was insecure, but to make our man not only a good customer, but a consultant to the bank, a man who'd done business with the bank in various arrangements, subject him to that loan that he didn't owe, and he never had any other funds. But
it seemed like you meet yourself coming here. You say for the in the usury argument that he was obligated to pay and therefore was usurious. But in the deceptive trade practice argument, you say the bank promised us we would not be liable to pay, and we weren't.
Well, if the court please, in the DTPA transaction, we're talking about another wholly unrelated transaction, and that's the Richardson-Fancher transaction after all of the credits and obligations of Mr. Fancher were out of that bank. They suggest not so. They wrote a letter to him, Justice Heck, Mr. Fancher, before they deducted that $40,000. We're sorry you left us, but you were a good customer. Hope you'll come back someday. That's in the record. The transaction by which the DTPA and tortious interference centers is not the same as those original loan and the renewal of the 350 and then the subsequent alleged release.
But isn't it predicated on the bank's promise that Fancher would never be held liable for the PCA portion of the loan extended to Brady and Fancher?
No. The only relevant connection between the two is they had this stale collateral security agreement after he was through the bank. The bank officer said customarily, we release that too when a man's out of our bank. We don't just carry like the sword of Damocles a collateral security agreement for him for everything. He didn't owe the bank anything then. When they did that transaction, and make this clear if I can, the cattle that were the subject of that transaction had previously been collateralized to this very bank. But he paid off a $200,000 note, and they kept that security agreement, and that's what they used to try to take that $40,000 out. Now, if I may add these thoughts, because I'm going to not have the time that you always like. Lawyers, after all these years, I've come to the realization I can't make Jess believe what I say this record shows, and he can't make me. And that's one of the things that this court is clearly for.
Mr. Cronjer, when he paid that off, did he ask to get released on that security agreement?
Justice Hightower, he was unhappy with things that had already happened, and he got a certificate of deposit back from him, closed his accounts. And when the Richardson cattle transaction came through, and he personally had no further obligation to that bank.
But he still had that security agreement with Brady. He didn't ask to be separated out of that.
He didn't. That was, and in that sense, I guess Justice Heck is correct. There is that much connection between the original transactions and they're waiting till this time to pull it down on him.
So he had left, but almost left, but not quite.
He got out as much as they let him.
But he didn't ask to get all the way out.
But they told him in writing that he was off the hook and that he didn't have any further obligation. Sorry you quit us.
On the Richards.
Yes.
And on his business that he'd operated separately from Brady. But he still recognized that in this deal with Brady that he still was there and he was still part of a collateral agreement?
He never recognized, Your Honor, and the jury so found, and there's no attack on that finding, that fraudulent representations were made to him about any responsibility he'd have for the Brady debt. Now that, if I don't do one more thing, I want to make it very clear, these briefs look to me as though they'd won the case or some summary judgment had been granted.
Now, when they told Mr. Fancher that they really weren't going to look to him, but they were looking to Brady, was Brady present?
I don't know, Judge, but let me say, the jury found in response to question four that they made those fraudulent representations to him that he would never be liable on the Brady debt, that he relied on those in executing the documents.
But at any time during those, does the record show that Mr. Brady was a party to that or knew about it, was present?
To those representations?
To those representations.
I can't fairly say, Dan Fontaine can tell you, but where I guess I'm striking out is all of the issues were answered favorably to Mr. Fancher, including that the transaction was used to cloak usury at all three of the original extensions, that the use of the stale security agreement, that's what we call it, interfered with that Brady Richardson contract. And it clearly did. They had no purpose if the fraud finding is correct.
The Brady Richardson contract?
The Fancher Richardson agreement. Excuse me for that. But I want to make it so clear that dealing with the gold transaction first, nobody seems to quarrel with the proposition that if this was a gold transaction, that is, if Mr. Fancher was required to assume the debt of another, that the holding of the Court of Appeals is correct. And the way they attack it in this court is by saying it was not the same lender, and that therefore it was not owed to this bank. That is simply not so under the record, both the documentation and the testimony. It clearly shows at the time, December 2nd of 1983, at that time, the debt of Brady was owned by this bank. They had exhibit number 9, the so-called side agreement, clearly held there was no lien and there was no funding, no obligation on the note until that occurred. They procured the note, and that is a direct gold situation. But even if it was not,
that's Brady's debt to Winter Garden PCA?
He owed Winter Garden, Chief Justice. And they would not fund the entire transaction until they had a first lien on Mr. Brady's Zavala property. So when they extended the line on the 23rd of November, some 10 days earlier, they didn't fund or make available funds to either of them at that time because the side agreement provided there wasn't any deal until they had purchased and had a prior lien on that property. So at the time they made their deduction from that line of credit, $121,000, it was owned by this bank and not Winter Garden or any other third party. And that, we say, is absolute unquestioned in this record. Now going a step further, we say that the Court of Appeals is correct in holding that the 12-1, question 12, number 1, that it was intended to cloak a usurious transaction. And their attack on that has just been a gross attack. But going back to number 4, the fraud finding, there's no attack on that. And it was fraud in esse, that is, fraud that vitiates it in inducement, and the jury found it as a fact, and that itself vitiates that transaction, the release.
Also, the Court of Appeals, while it held there was an obligation of good faith,